This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Evictions in Indianapolis are high. Mayor Joe Hogsett's administration sought to address some issues around evictions and landlord disputes with a so-called tenant rights initiative. But Indiana lawmakers have amended a bill that, if passed, could render the city's initiative useless. If you have questions or comments on our show today, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail. Call 866-476-3881 and just give us your name, where you're calling from, and your quick question or comment, and we'll do our best to get it into the conversation today. Again, that's 866-476-3881. Joining me in the studio now is Brandon Beeler, Housing Director for Indiana Legal Services. Thanks for coming in, Brandon.
Thanks, Matt.
Matt Giffen is Deputy Director of the Indianapolis Office of Public Health and Safety. Matt, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Matt, we'll start with you. Can you tell us about the tenants' rights initiative that was proposed by the city? What would it do?
It has three or four parts that are worth emphasizing. The first is that it gives tenants a notice of their rights and responsibilities, requires landlords to provide that to tenants when a lease begins or when it's renewed. And that's a one-pager that we put a draft of in the ordinance that it hits the basics of Indiana law. So habitability, security deposit, lockout, discrimination, stuff like that. Connected to that is a tenant information hotline that's going to give tenants access to the third item, which is the legal assistance project we're setting up with Indiana Legal Services and Brandon here. And that has some components. There's an eviction defense part, which is continuation of work that they're already doing. And there's also what we're calling the Tenant Legal Assistance Project, which is to help tenants who have identified potential violations of their rights. And kind of the fourth piece, the glue that holds us all together, is a retaliation protection.
And when we say retaliation protection, what are some examples of retaliation? How could landlords retaliate against their renters?
So the ordinance defines what retaliation is as a series of actions, but the most common is you evict a tenant because they did something that you don't like. You raise their rent. You lock them out. You otherwise make the conditions of their housing worse. And it's because of a protected action that they took.
Mm.
And a protected action would be hiring a lawyer, calling the health department because of a problem in your rental unit. It could be speaking out to somebody else at the city about a violation of your rights.
Because it's legal and by a lot of people's definitions, okay to evict a tenant if they don't, say, pay their rent or something like that. There are a number of reasons that you to evict a tenant.
Right.
But this is sort of defining a distinction between a legitimate reason and an illegitimate reason for doing things like this.
Right. Most states, in fact, 42 at my last count, have some sort of statewide retaliation protection that does something similar to what we're trying to do at the city level here in Indianapolis. And that's a recognition that, yeah, this is, you know, eviction is basically a contract action in the law. It's saying we have a lease, you violated it in some way, so I'm throwing you out. Most states put some protections around that basic contract action, recognizing that, you know, this is somebody's home. This is the place where they live, and getting kicked out has a number of cascading consequences that really direly affect people's lives. So what the retaliation provision does is says, yeah, you may have grounds, you may have a pretext to throw somebody out, but if you're doing it because they're exercising their rights, we're going to give them at least some zone of protection around that. What a city can do is limited, and that's why what the state has done and is proposing to do is so important here, and I think we're going to be talking about that.
Brandon.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the most pervasive, what we call retaliatory eviction, is what Matt just described, is that the landlord is not maintaining the rental conditions in the home. Here in Indiana, we do have a warranty of habitability that's codified in the statute, and it's something that actually landlords in their leases can't contract out of. So even if there's an as-is provision in a lease, it's void per the statute. So what happens here, and really it's very, very pervasive in Marion County specifically, that a tenant will try to talk to their landlord to get something fixed that the landlord by statute has to maintain. the landlords out there know that once a tenant calls the health department, that if the landlord can evict the tenant, the health department here loses jurisdiction over enforcing any sort of actions or claims regarding code violations specifically. And I have a client story I can share that illustrates exactly the need for an ordinance like this. Would be, just a few months ago, I was in representing a tenant who was being evicted for after the health department found and cited numerous violations of this apartment complex, actually evicted the tried to evict the tenant, saying, "Well, you got to leave. The conditions are bad, and you have to vacate." No, that's not the result. That's not right. And so this tenant who was fortunate enough to get an attorney and call our office and get someone to represent her, it ultimately turned out that she won close. It was a harder case to win than you would think to win. But at the end of the day, she still is kind of at a loss because now there's an eviction filing on her record. And to this day, she has trouble finding affordable housing. So she has damage done to her, and there's really no other legal remedy she has at this point. Mm.
Brandon, can you tell us what Indiana Legal Services does?
Sure. We are a statewide nonprofit law firm. We're funded mostly through the Legal Services Corporation. We represent low-income clients in a number of civil matters. We only do civil matters. So obviously housing is a big one we do. We do family law. We have a domestic violence team. We have benefits. Pretty much anything civil-wise, is who we help represent, and it's all like low-income individuals.
And how did you get involved in this initiative with the city?
Sure. When Matt began working with the city, his department and the mayor's was very interested in tackling homelessness. And, over the past few years, and you probably have addressed it on this show before, other shows here on WFYI, eviction's a big topic now. Matt Desmond wrote a book called Evicted, and it's really highlighting things. And the reason in Indianapolis it got a big, in Indiana, I guess I should say too, Indianapolis specifically, depending on what you listen to, ranks in the top 2, 4, sometimes 14 of highest evictions in the country. So to put that in perspective, here in Indianapolis, we have more evictions than the city of Chicago and Los Angeles combined. So,
and that's numerically? You're not talking percentages or anything like that?
Correct, numerically, just by the numbers.
And we do have a higher rate of eviction than both those cities as well.
Hmm. Well, I guess so, if we're talking numbers, just hard numbers.
Right.
I feel like when I have rented in the past, I have been given a few pages of boilerplate to kind of I don't know that it's informing me of my rights, but I feel like I've seen it before where it's like, hey, you have the right to do this. You have the right to do this. So it seems like some landlords are providing renters with their rights. Is it that it's insufficient, or is it that not all of them are doing it? Is it an Indianapolis problem?
I'd say – first of all, there's a lot of precedent around the country for notices of rights being mandated. It's done in Chicago. It's done in Bloomington, Indiana. There are a lot of places that do that and have had success with that. And I think a lot of landlords on their own initiative do something like that. What we're worried about is bad landlords, the small percentage of landlords who are potentially exploiting the bargaining power disparity between themselves and tenants, who are exploiting tenants who have less access to information about their rights, are in high-stress living situations, have a lot of stress factors pulling them in a lot of different directions at once. So the notice of rights will help everybody. We think it will help landlords and tenants, but the people that will help the most are the ones that otherwise maybe wouldn't have access to this information.
Frankly, also, I think it's consistency. I think some landlords do that, and that's great. And I think there's a lot of great examples of really good landlords who inform their tenants of what their rights are. But I think it's to get consistency across the board throughout the county or throughout Indianapolis. You know, Chief Justice Rush, who's our Chief Justice here at this Indiana State Supreme Court, spent last year observing landlord-tenant courts here in Marion County. And the biggest takeaway she took from that experience, which she discussed in January in her State of the Judiciary address, was that there was just a lack of information from the tenant side. She watched over 100 eviction cases, and most landlords were all represented by an attorney. And I think everyone she watched that day, no tenant had an attorney. And it's just an imbalance. It's not, it's information. So I think that what's one of the great things the notice provision that's contained in the city ordinance is consistency across the board that all renters, because it's going to be available on the indy.gov website, it'll be available on our website, it's that all tenants can have a place to look without actually having to hire an attorney if they're maybe over income for our services. They can actually look to somewhere to know what their rights really are.
Mm. And Brandon raised a good point about that. As you said, people sign a lot of boilerplate. People sign a lot of things that they don't necessarily read. So we're certainly not going to rest on the fact that we're requiring landlords to give this out. We're going to use every other avenue at our disposal to make sure that not only is it in your lease and you're required to keep it, but you're seeing it in other places. The city's talking about it. Other people you have interactions with are talking about it. It'll be hopefully available at the small claims courts, for instance. So it's kind of a full court press in terms of getting that information out there.
It seems like landlords would want to do their diligence to make sure that they're covered by providing these sorts of things. But the so-called bad landlords, we'll just call them that. Do we have a percentage of how many bad landlords there are in Indianapolis who we're trying to correct with this measure?
It's a small number. I think there's a lot of repeat players in that field, though. Mm. I know I'm sure legal services has encountered in their eviction defense work that a relatively small number of landlords will come up over and over again. Mm. The task is made more difficult by the fact that you have shell companies. You have one landlord who may have five or six different entities that technically owns a property or is technically the property manager. So it can be kind of a whack-a-mole game to figure out who exactly is a landlord in some cases.
How did this initiative come about? Has this been planned for a while?
We started researching this late last summer, early last fall.
Okay.
So it's been germinating for several months.
And does Indianapolis already have some regulations that it's passed related to landlords or tenants, or is this the first of its kind here?
We have a landlord registry program that it's had some difficulties with enforcement, and one of the reasons that we're excited about this ordinance is that we think the information that's generated by the notice of rights, our partnership with legal services, will help us get more information about the market, about who are tenants, who are landlords, and maybe drive up numbers for the landlord registry as well. But other than that, there has not been a lot of separate landlord-tenant regulation at the city level here.
We're talking today about a measure that the Indianapolis City County Council is putting forth to require landlords to inform tenants of their rights, as well as a number of other things. And after the break, we'll talk more about the initiative from the city of Indianapolis, why it was created, and the move by state lawmakers that could stop it from happening. And as always, we would love your questions or comments. How should issues around landlords and evictions be addressed? Let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking about an initiative designed to protect tenants in Indianapolis proposed by city administration. And we would love your questions or comments on the topic. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or just leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from. You can do that at 866-476-3881. Again, 866-476-3881. And in the studio, we're joined again by Brandon Beeler, Housing Director for Indiana Legal Services, and Matt Giffen, Deputy Director of the Indianapolis Office of Public Health and Safety. Thanks again for sticking around to both of you. So what happened at the State House on the same day that the council approved this initiative?
At about 10 in the morning, we got an email alert from one of our city representatives at the State House saying that an amendment had been attached to an existing Senate bill, SB 340, that had several sort of catastrophic consequences for what we were trying to do. And again, this is the morning of the vote, the final vote on our council ordinance.
And what was – I know that SB 340 was sort of unrelated, but
yes.
What was it about?
It was originally mostly about eminent domain.
Eminent domain.
Right.
Okay. And what would it have done?
You know, honestly, I don't even know what the original subject matter of the bill would have done. There were several amendments added to it in addition to the one that concerned us. One was about street parking in Indianapolis. So some random sort of grab bag stuff. And I think that is under the rules of the General Assembly and the Indiana Constitution can be somewhat problematic to add unrelated amendments to bills.
And so what consequences would it have on your initiative, this new amendment added to SB 340?
The amendment says at its outset that it preempts the ability of cities anywhere in Indiana essentially to take any kind of action in the landlord-tenant sphere. It specifically calls out giving tenants a notice of their rights as one of the things that will be prohibited to cities going forward. So it specifically targets our notice of rights provision. Secondly, it has a retaliation protection for tenants that would also preempt anything that any city does. Now, speaking for the city of Indianapolis, we would welcome a state-level tenant retaliation protection if it were an effective tenant retaliation protection. This amendment, in our view, is not. It has enough exceptions and caveats built into it that it is, on the whole, remarkably landlord-friendly and would, at best, represent a half step forward rather than serious progress in this area.
Do you know who – I mean, I guess they're officially not related, officially. The city initiative and the amendment to SB 340 are officially unrelated. But was there evidence, do you know, of – I don't know, I guess any kind of a tip-off that maybe would have caused it? It happened the same day. It seems a little stranger than coincidence.
Unlike the General Assembly, we did all of our business in public. The mayor announced this in January. There was a committee hearing early in February, February 5th, I think. And then we had our final council vote on the 24th. So they got plenty of tip-off at the State House that this was happening because we invited public participation in our lawmaking process.
What do we know, I guess, about why this amendment was introduced? What are some of the pragmatic reasons that you've heard in favor of this amendment to SB 340?
The amendment, as far as we can tell, was proffered by the Indiana Apartment Association, and their members are people in the landlord community. And the concerns they've talked about that I've heard of are wanting uniformity statewide and wanting to avoid unnecessary burdens on landlords, they say, because that will ultimately impact the stock of housing in the state and will have negative impact for everybody. I, of course, would dispute both of those assertions, but that's the argument they're making.
So it's kind of like a way sounds like they're saying they don't want to get bogged down in differing regulations from city to city to city, and they want, if anything, one statewide solution.
Right, and they said in the public hearing process for our ordinance that they were concerned that our retaliation provision, as they would put it, creates a guilty until proven innocent regime. Again, I strongly dispute that, but they clearly think that they would be negatively impacted by our citywide retaliation provision.
The guilty until proven innocent thing was that was curious to me too as I was reading about it. It seemed like that language was a little strong for the argument behind it, I suppose. What can you explain that a little bit better, the guilty until proven innocent?
What our ordinance does, and this is what a lot of state ordinances do, and it's what the revised Uniform Landlord-Tenant Act, which a number of states have adopted nationwide, does, is creates a rebuttable presumption that a landlord action taken within a certain period of time is retaliation. So in our ordinance, it's 60 days. In a lot of places, it's 6 months or even up to a year in Chicago. So what that means is you evict a tenant, say, 2 weeks after you find out that they called the health department and got an inspection because the furnace wasn't working in an apartment. There will be a presumption that that is retaliation. The landlord then has to say, okay, it wasn't retaliation. Actually, I did this because they violated their lease, because they trashed their apartment, because they were behind on rent. A legitimate reason to evict a tenant.
All legitimate reasons.
Right. So it's a way of shifting the evidentiary burden. This is this is not a criminal statute at the state level or the city level. This is a civil ordinance. So guilty until proven innocent is obviously hyperbole because we're not talking about throwing anybody in jail or making anybody guilty of a crime. What we're talking about is a civil penalty. But even at that, all it does is basically says the landlord needs to show that what they were doing was legitimate and not retaliation. It's burden shifting.
What is the Indiana Department of or Indiana Apartment Association? What is the Indiana Apartment Association?
It's a trade group of people that are in that business. It's a and obviously has lobbying functions.
And they were behind this amendment to SB 340?
Yes. We suspected as much.
As best we can tell.
And actually at the General Assembly today, this morning, their representative said that they proffered the language that became this amendment. So that is now a confirmed fact.
Quick note, we did send an invitation to the Indiana Apartment Association to participate in the show today, and they declined. But they did release a statement in response to the committee vote on SB 340, where this amendment was added. It says, quote, "The Indiana Apartment Association supports enacting protections for tenants on a state level that keeps Hoosiers in their homes and provides relief directly to tenants who have been wronged. This bill would mitigate inconsistent regulations that would vary from city to city. The potential patchwork of policies will not only create confusion among landlords and tenants, but will ultimately increase the cost of housing," end quote. First, what's your general reaction to this statement? What did you think when you heard it?
I think it overpromises with respect to the state bill, and it is unduly alarmist with respect to the city ordinance that it's attempting to preempt.
Brandon, what about you? What did you think when you saw that?
Sure. I mean, I can speak mostly to just how this would affect our clients. And this would, you know, when we read the city ordinance compared to maybe the language proposed in Senate Bill 3 and the amendment of 340, you know, really what the city is trying to do is just give information. And, you know, we have disclosures in a number of other commercial goods. You know, if you buy a car, have a mortgage and a home, there are certain disclosures that are required. You know, here this is in Indiana, it's been established that a tenant's rental property is protected property interest, meaning it can't be taken away without certain due process. So this is simply a matter of just giving information to tenants. And so we don't, you know, we support that. And again, trying to follow along with Chief Justice Drush's charge to correct this imbalance between tenant and landlord information.
And if I could just give a couple of details about why we find this state amendment to be objectionable and why the statement from the Apartment Association that this is giving tenants protections needs to be examined more closely. This bill has a number of exceptions in it to what constitutes a retaliation, and it also treats the burden of proof differently in a way that we think will severely disincentivize tenants trying to exercise their rights here. It caps the tenant's recovery at 1 month's rent. It puts the burden of proof explicitly on the tenant rather than the landlord. And maybe most objectionably, it has a fee-shifting provision, which means that if a tenant tries to assert that an eviction or another action was a retaliation and they lose, the tenant has to pay the landlord's attorney's fees, which is punitive and will have a massive chilling effect on somebody trying to exercise their rights. And the reason that we and a lot of other cities and states that have regulated in this field put the burden on landlords here is because there's a massive power and economic disparity here between landlords and tenants. It doesn't make sense to require a tenant to come up with the evidence showing that, you know, they're in the right when the landlord has the resources. The landlord almost always has access to an attorney when a tenant does not. So if there's a balance that you're trying to strike here, it strikes me as illogical and also highly self-interested for this Apartment Association written bill to throw the burden on tenants and then say they have to pay our lawyers if they lose.
We're talking to Matt Giffen, Deputy Director of the Indianapolis Office of Public Health and Safety, and Brandon Beeler, Housing Director of for Indiana Legal Services, about an initiative from the Indianapolis City County Council that would require landlords to inform renters of their rights, as well as a number of other things. And I guess the question that I have now, after hearing the Indiana Apartment Association's statement about their desire for a statewide regulation as opposed to different ordinances in cities from city to city. Are there right now those inconsistent regulations on this in cities across Indiana?
The Apartment Association's representative testified this morning in front of the conference committee, and he was asked, okay, what other inconsistent regulations are you trying to target here? All he could come up with was Indianapolis. Now, there are other landlord-tenant regulations around the state. Bloomington has one. South Bend has one. But it's very clear from the timing and from, you know, the words out of the mouth of their own representative that this bill, this amendment, was written to preempt Indianapolis's ordinance.
Have either of you talked to them, the Indiana Apartment Association, about this?
The mayor's office in Indianapolis has had communications with them. They made some suggestions along with some other organizations at the time that our bill was first introduced. We did make an amendment to reflect or to accommodate some of the suggestions early on. So, yeah, there's been communication.
I assume that there are a number of landlords here who work in multiple cities and who own properties in multiple cities in Indiana. Is there validity to this argument that a patchwork of policies could cause problems for them, Brandon?
Well, you know, there have been a lot of studies, and I'm going to cite again Matthew Desmond, and, you know, he runs a blog called Eviction Lab, and a lot of sociologists and people throughout the country have kind of studied different solutions to kind of solving this eviction crisis, which Indianapolis, again, we're on the list. We're in an eviction crisis, and that's not really a political statement. That's just a matter of fact of where we are and where the city is when it comes to renters and rentals in this here at home and here in Indiana. You know, one of the things that's been most successful are local solutions. There are just different needs in different communities. And as a statewide director of a civil law firm who sees the different needs. You know, we have a lot of rural areas here in Indiana that are going to have just different needs and their kind of rentals that are just rentals that aren't even contemplated here in a metropolitan area like Indianapolis. So they've found a lot of success in that. And, you know, one thing that I think, you know, we may get into what the nuts and bolts of the ordinance are and what legal assistance will be provided. But, you know, looking to New York State, and I mean, they did do it on a statewide level, but New York City has this right to counsel now where tenants by right, like, a you know, essentially a public defender for eviction court. And the numbers, because New York City, of course, no, I shouldn't say of course, but, you know, New York City was the highest and their numbers have just drastically fallen. We are higher than them now. And that was now effectively a local solution. So local solutions, the data is showing, is a very effective measure and means, because it's going to be hard to get statewide consensus, especially in a state like Indiana that has so many different types of communities that it's going to be hard to find some single solution for everyone. And I think, again, the city's tried to take into account what specifically Indianapolis here needs.
Yeah, I'd say that from the mayor's office perspective, we've certainly worked with people at the state level, and we worked with the Apartment Association and MIBOR and other industry groups, and we hope to continue to work with them. There's some validity to the concern about a patchwork of regulations, but there are a couple things to say about that. One is that our ordinance, we don't think, imposes any sort of undue burden or undue inconvenience even on landlords. And secondly, we would welcome a statewide solution that was more genuinely protective of tenants. That would be the best solution for everybody if everybody in the state, not just the residents of Indianapolis, had a retaliation protection.
Brandon, you work with attorneys who work with people on this all the time. You're in court all the time about this, and you're settling as well. And I guess you mentioned the eviction crisis. Why, from your perspective and those you work with, the professionals that you deal with all the time, why is there such an eviction crisis in Indianapolis?
I think, again, I know I keep saying it, but I think Chief Justice Rush nailed it on the head. It's become transactional. It's a, you know, if anyone today goes and witnesses a landlord-tenant court, it's really just a matter of a few questions from the judge. The landlords, you know, are there represented by counsel. Tenants generally are not. And typically they're behind in rent, so clearly they're having some financial struggles. The only option available really that they're presented is either maybe pay and stay if they're lucky, or when can you get out? And, you know, a recent sort of equitable remedy that's been kind of done here in Marion County is to put on the judgment, this is not an eviction if you vacate by the 30th or something like that. But frankly and effectively, it is, because that filing still shows up when those tenants try to apply for other housing, especially other affordable housing. It looks like no one really looks to what the result is. They just see that someone's had an eviction filed on them. So because of the nature, the transactional nature of simply not really, you know, tenants are, you know, it's a quick, speedy process. That's really what the point of our small claims courts are here in Marion County specifically. It's meant to be speedy justice. And so it's really just a matter of, it's become so routine in shop. And that's what I think, you know, when we enter, we try to, you know, give tenants as much information and knowing their rights. And when you really examine them, sometimes you see, wait, this isn't transactional. But because of the volume of how many evictions are filed here in the city, it's just become so transactional, even from the judicial level.
That's interesting. Can you explain that again about how an eviction cannot technically be an eviction? Because an eviction, to me, the most dramatic and definitive part of an eviction is the person being forced out of their home, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
But how can an eviction not be an eviction?
So it's a great question. It's very technical and it's very confusing. It frankly.
And who does it serve when an eviction is not an eviction, technically?
Sure. I mean, I think what the judges are trying to do, I think the small claims judges are trying, and I won't speak for them, but I think they're trying to do what the best thing, because they know the effect of having like the judgment of eviction on the record. So I think they try to put these notes in judgments of, well, if they leave, we're not considering this eviction. But at the end of the day, if you think practically what happens here, they still have to leave.
Mm.
And I guess without getting too in the weeds here, but eviction in Indiana is different than other cities and other states. It's actually a two-part process. The first part is what we all think of eviction, which is who gets possession to the rental unit. That's the first step. The second step is what's called the damages hearing. So should possession be granted back to a landlord or an owner, regardless if it's a move out or whether it's a flat up, here's a writ of eviction, you got to get out in 24 hours or whatever that is. The case pins and stays for a few more months. So the purpose is for both sides to see if anyone has damages against the other. But, you know, while someone's evicted, this case could still be pending and affect their ability to get future housing.
We'll keep talking to our guests after the break about a new initiative from Indianapolis meant to protect tenants and an amendment going through the State House that might negate it. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now to our discussion on an initiative in Indianapolis designed to protect tenants. In the studio, we're joined again by Brandon Beeler, Housing Director for Indiana Legal Services, and Matt Giffen, Deputy Director of the Indianapolis Office of Public Health and Safety. Thanks again, both of you, for taking the time to talk with us today about this. And as always, we would love to hear your questions and comments. We're on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can record a short voicemail with your name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. So, Brian Mowry, the Republican minority leader on the Indianapolis City County Council, said the initiative would put landlords in a guilty until proven innocent situation. We've talked a little bit about this. Is it fair to be concerned about this part of it? We've unpacked this a little bit about maybe swinging the pendulum too far in the other direction.
I don't think so, and especially at the city level, I can speak as to our ordinance because of the way that the enforcement process would work. It is not a prepaid ticket. It's not like a parking ticket. In order to be assessed a penalty for retaliation, you would have to be found to have retaliated by a judge in the Superior Court. So a rebuttable presumption, it just sets the starting point for how that court hearing is going to go if the landlord disputes that they retaliated. The landlord will always be in a position to show that they took an action alleged to be retaliatory for legitimate reasons. And we think it's more appropriate to put that relatively small logistical or inconvenience burden on the landlord rather than the tenant.
And again, this is about information. It's simply about giving tenants information to their rights. It's frankly as simple as that.
But it's about more than that. That's only one of the four tenets of this initiative, right? It's about giving information, but it's also about legal representation and a number of other things. But the two parts that SB 340's amendment would affect would be that, the providing information and what's the other?
The retaliation protection.
And the retaliation protection.
And I think that's a good thing to emphasize is that the city has appropriated $250,000 to the tenant information hotline, and the majority of it will go towards our legal assistance projects. And the state action will not affect that. We will be able to provide some legal help to tenants. We certainly hope that our other parts of the ordinance aren't preempted, but we can salvage at least some of this no matter what.
We got a listener voicemail from Martha. She's commenting on real estate pricing in the city. Let's listen to Martha.
My name is Martha. I'm calling from Indianapolis. And when I moved here from Pennsylvania, I was surprised at how expensive it was to rent and how reasonably real estate was priced.
Thank you, Martha, for calling. And anyone want to respond to Martha?
I'll say I think that that's accurate, that rents have gone up in Indianapolis. They've gone up a lot in the sort of the downtown core, and they've gone up even in areas that are lower income where people can all afford to pay higher rents. And I think we have a problem with housing stock in this city. And that's one aspect of what the Apartment Association said that I think is completely valid, which is one part of the solution to a housing problem in Indianapolis is creating more housing. Mm. Absolutely.
Can one of you give us a sense for some of the common situations people get into that lead to evictions or significant disputes with landlords?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the most common would be these habitability ones where tenants aren't really sure who's responsible for fixing what. And I won't go through all like the statutory things here, but, you know, what's responsible. And then, you know, maybe calling the health department to kind of get an analysis if there's something wrong that the landlord needs to fix. And then, you know, the landlord really, in some cases, making the decision that it's going to be more cost effective to evict the tenant. So maybe just not accepting rent or maybe finding some pretext to find a way that would breach the contract or breach the lease in order to evict the tenant. So that way the landlord would not have to deal with any enforcement habitability. And so then it's perpetual because, you know, they'll leave the unit vacant for a week or two or a month or two and put someone else right in the same unit that's never been fixed. And it's just a continuous cycle that you can't get out, that without anything else we can't get out of.
How about an example of one that would lead to another perhaps in the future? The situation, maybe a renter who has, I guess, been evicted multiple times. What would that example look like?
I'm sorry, clarify about renter being evicted multiple times.
Well, it says you said that this is a cycle that perpetuates on itself when it comes to some people. And that's what this measure that the City County Council is one of the reasons that it put it forward, I guess. What would be an example of an eviction, I suppose.
Sure.
One of these common reasons.
One of the common reasons, sure, you know, is just that, an example would be a client I had once. It was in the middle of winter and she was renting a home and part of the roof fell off and it was snowing and hailing and, you know, everything she tried to do to get the landlord to come fix it because that's a structural issue and that is part of the landlord's responsibility to maintain. Eventually, she called the health department. She had to put some of her – and she's low income and had to put some of her money to buy a tarp just to cover it. Landlord ultimately evicted her and she got – they went to court, said, oh, she's not paying her rent. The reason she was not paying her rent is because she was out of money because she had to spend her own money to fix at least temporarily so her home with her children was not being snowed inside of. And as far as I know, I kind of kept an eye on that property. This happened a number of years ago that I don't know if that hole ever got fixed. And I think there's been three or four other renters in that property since.
Have issues around evictions and landlords worsened here in recent years? Or has this been a problem for a while?
I think things have gotten more severe on the eviction front. I know that I've talked to several of the small claims judges who feel like they're getting increased volume of eviction cases. And, you know, one of the impetuses behind us pursuing this ordinance was some activism on the part of the small claims judges and other people that are involved in the system and are seeing the numbers out in the field, as it were. And, yeah, I think the numbers that Brandon and I were quoting a couple minutes ago were from 2016. It takes a while to get updated numbers, but there's every reason to think that this is a problem that's continuing to be severe.
But I guess what I'm trying to get at is why Indianapolis? Why do we have the highest eviction rate when you, depending on the figures that you look at, what is allowing for that? Are we just unlucky enough to have a number of bad landlords here or
well,
what?
You look at the nationwide statistics, and I think that the legal regime in our state has a role to play here. Indianapolis, South Bend, Fort Wayne are all in the top 18 nationwide for eviction rates. Other cities in the Midwest, cities that you could compare Indianapolis to and a lot of other economic indicators, or cities that actually Indianapolis is doing a lot better than in a lot of respects, cities like Detroit, Cincinnati, St. Louis, have lower eviction rates than Indianapolis. So I think there is a state legal regime problem here, and that's something that the General Assembly needs to be addressing.
And I think it's also just a general lack of tenant protection laws. I mean, it's a, you know, the law here is a very vague business-friendly law. I think it's hard to – it's just such a – I guess what I'm trying to say is it's due process. It's the fact that these rental homes are protected property interests. That's, and that part always seems to get overlooked, the fact that you have the right to privacy in your own home even if that is a rental home. So I think that carving out what mechanisms of due process are required before having a tenant being forced out of their home – there's, it's not clearly defined. We try our best to hold landlords to the small amount of requirements that there are and make sure that they follow those. But otherwise, there's really no clear scheme for what is due process prior to an eviction.
We're talking to Brandon Beeler, Housing Director for Indiana Legal Services, and Matt Giffen, Deputy Director of the Indianapolis Office of Public Health and Safety. So part of this problem, it seems, is that some landlords who own properties here don't live in the city. And that's the same anywhere. I mean, there are people who own apartments in Chicago that don't live there, but rent them out. How common is that, though?
Now, this is anecdotal at this point, but we think it's fairly common. And one of the reasons that we feel like we need to strengthen our collection of data, whether it's from the landlord registry or from this notice provision from our legal assistance project, is to find out just how common. And one of the reasons that that's a problem is not only sort of regulatory or enforcement, but because it becomes a much more casual dollars and cents type decision to do evictions when you have absentee landlords. And it creates a problem of vacant properties, which leads to knock-on effects in neighborhoods and communities.
And to Matt's point, too, about the needing more legal remedies, with more attorneys and more legal assistance through the pro bono, through private bar, through other legal aid organizations, you know, going back to kind of legal mechanisms to have standing to bring a case, you know, judges just don't, because of the volume, don't have time to look into every plaintiff to see, are they out of state? Is this person bringing this claim actually someone who has standing to bring an eviction claim? Only when a legal, you know, either an attorney or someone else gets involved to do that initial inquiry can we find that, oh, no, no, this is an out-of-state actor, and pull those, you know, dot those I's and cross those T's. That's, again, the importance, again, to Matt's point about the judicial or legal remedies and enforcement or legal remedies to the solution.
And just quickly, I criticized the state bill for overpromising earlier. So I should be clear about one thing, which is that this ordinance is not going to fix the eviction problem in Indianapolis. It's not going to solve some of the underlying economic issues. It's not going to solve the fact that many tenants are behind on their rent. It's intended to change the incentives for bad landlords to some extent, and it is intended to disseminate as much information as possible. We think this will help. It is step one in what needs to be a much larger engagement with the problem of housing and landlord tenant law.
It seems like in some of these scenarios the problem is property management. Do landlords have an obligation to provide adequate management at their rental properties?
Adequate management per se, I don't think that's part of state law. They do have an obligation under state law to provide adequate conditions of housing. And that does include common area maintenance in some cases, some things like elevators and stairwells. But to have an on-site manager, that is not a specific requirement, no.
Would that be a possible solution to something like this, or is that not really in the cards, I guess, from your legal standpoint, Brandon?
Oh, goodness. I don't know if on-site necessarily matters as much. I think it's just more engagement, having someone to – having the tenants having some point person. And, I mean, really, it could be out of state. I don't think we necessarily have a problem with that. It's just having a point person who will address conditions issues or safety issues or public health issues, any – you know, those kind of things. Tenants don't have resources to that. And then – and or, you know, turning it around that rather than having a culture of such a transactional – landlord-tenant court where the easier solution where really I would – you know, I think we frankly would say the landlord's contemplation should be not – should not be should we fix the unit or evict the tenant, which is the easier of the two. It should always be we should fix the unit. That was – you know, and I think that it's just become the culture of where we are now, and I think trying to wean that back a little bit to be more thoughtful and – and have landlords say, okay, actually it's going to be better to fix than evict.
But the stopper here sometimes can be communication. What if tenants simply can't get a hold of their landlord? Does that happen often?
That does happen often. Yes and no. I mean, yes, tenants have – I've had a number of clients not sure who to contact. That's a lot of times why we get the health department involved, because the health department has to notify the owner at least, and they will do their due diligence to find who owns a property and communicate that way. I would say once we get through that process, it gets a little bit more rare, because, again, that process usually then an attorney gets involved. So at least they may be sued, but they have someone to talk to. But, again, they shouldn't have to be sued to figure out who they can talk to about their conditions. Mm.
If we set aside politics for a minute and let's pretend we have all the money in the world and can address this, what policies would you implement to have the biggest impact on this?
Well, some things that are sort of low-hanging fruit, I think, would be for Indiana to just catch up to its neighboring states. And we can do that with a genuine retaliation protection for tenants, with a notice to quit statute that functions effectively, with something like a rent withholding or a rent escrow right under state law, and something, you know, a repair and deduct remedy where you're allowed to, if the landlord is not able to or willing to fix something that impacts the habitability of the apartment, then the tenant can repair and then deduct it from their rent. These are things that almost all of our neighboring states do, that the majority of states do, but that Indiana does not do.
Do what neighboring states do look a little bit like what the Indianapolis City County Council is proposing?
Well,
or is that just a few steps?
We're highly limited under state law for what we can do at the city level. So we couldn't do a repair and deduct remedy. We couldn't impose a rent withholding right because that's preempted by state law. So in a narrow sense, the retaliation provision is an attempt to bring Indianapolis forward in that respect and to match what other cities and states around the country are doing. But there's a lot that would have to be at the state level, the way our legal system works.
Our tenant clients, definitely what Matt said, that was number one thing I thought too, was an anti-retaliation sort of law or statute. The only other thing I can think of, which we are already doing a bit, and the city again through this initiative gave us funding to continue, was our eviction avoidance project, which does our best to try to mirror this right to counsel. So I would say some sort of right to counsel approach, because what we've seen through our attorney who does this work and in New York State as well, that obviously the government has paid for and has drawn out on in a larger scale. It disrupts this transactional culture we have. It forces landlord attorneys to really talk with tenant attorneys and or tenants, usually even before filing of a case, to really try to get to a solution so the tenant does not have this public record that they cannot get rid of and that is always will follow them with every search that they have for new affordable housing.
And what they've done in New York and some other places is kind of colloquially called a civil Gideon right. I think that's an interesting illusion in that Gideon v. Wainwright, the Supreme Court case, recognized that no matter how poor you are, you have a right to an attorney appointed by the state, paid for by the state in a criminal case. And there's good reason to think that housing, while it's not crime and punishment, it's not life and death, is very close to life and death for a lot of people. It's a very important right. It's important to other aspects of people's lives. And there may be reason to think that areas around the country will find their way to something like a civil Gideon right over time. I don't think Indianapolis or Indiana is in a position right now to be at the forefront on that. I think it would be a costly remedy. New York is certainly paying a lot to do that, and I think it'll be interesting to see what results from that experiment that they're doing. But that's something that I think policymakers should be thinking about.
Matt Giffen is Deputy Director of the Indianapolis Office of Public Health and Safety. Matt, thanks for stopping by today.
Thank you.
Brandon Beeler is Housing Director for Indiana Legal Services. Thank you.
Thank you, Matt.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our Managing Editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, it is out there wherever you get your podcasts. And be sure to subscribe so you always know what we're talking about. Tomorrow is the Friday Pitch-In, where we'll catch up on what's been happening at the State House. We'll also dive into a few other stories we think you'll want to hear. One with our education reporter about teacher accountability, which is moving through the State House. In the meantime, we are on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Thank you so much for listening. This is All In.